Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello there, I'm Jason Shulman, and this is New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. My guest today... Hello there, I'm Jason Shulman, and this is New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. My guest today on the podcast is Francesca Merlin. She's professor of anthropology at the Australian National University. She's here to talk about her new book, Dynamic Difference in Australia, Indigenous Past and Present in a Settler Country. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2018. Francesca, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on. So, Francesca, this book is about the relationships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Australia who are engaging with each other across major disparities, you know, of knowledge and cultural orientation. What does difference mean to you?
Well, difference has to do with the idea of contrast. It has to do with... People or institutions who have something in common on the one hand and who contrast with others on the other hand. So the book is generally about, or a lot of it is about how Indigenous and non-Indigenous people have differed in their experience of each other, of their foreignness of each other. And I try to follow out that question about how they have differed over a fairly long span of time. So I think that's one thing that's a little different and a little unusual about the book, is trying to pursue that over the period beginning from early colonization into the present.
So how does one go about doing that? And maybe you can tell us a bit about what an anthropologist actually does to do their research.
Yes. Well, it is perhaps a bit unusual to delve as much as I did, for an anthropologist to delve as much as I did into the archival record and into the record of journals. But if you read these journals of explorers and colonizers and so on carefully, of course, you find a lot in them that is really ethnographic. It's ethnographic in the sense that it's ground level, it's closely observed. It, of course, is often quite one-sided in that the journalist is giving you his version of what's going on. But usually these things do provide some insights into how the people that they were encountering actually experienced things as well. So that's one way in which I went about it. I had for some period of time been reading a lot of the colonial journals of encounter in Australia. And of course, you can't do that without going back as early as Captain Cook, for example, who was himself a pretty great journalist. And he had quite a number of people with him who also wrote very fulsome accounts of what was going on. So that's one source. And that source extends really over time, because as you can imagine, and like the United States itself, people were entering, explorers and settlers were entering different parts of Australia at different times. And so you get the opening of different parts of the country in that sense. You get these encounters between Indigenous and non-Indigenous happening from, 1770 right on through into the latter 19th century.
Your book,
so that's one thing.
Go ahead.
Oh, and I was just going to say the other major thing that I've drawn on is, of course, my own ethnographic experience, my own experience of living mostly in Northern Australia and in a number of different Aboriginal settings. The principal one where I've spent time is in a town, actually, which is kind of an open setting in the sense that there are Indigenous people living in and around, mostly around the town, who've come from all kinds of regions around it, and there's also a majority white population. So that's the other part that I bring to bear on the book.
Yeah, and as listeners will probably be able to tell, you were actually born in New Mexico. You came to Australia in 1976. Maybe before we get to Captain Cook, kind of going back to the long history, maybe you can tell us just a bit about kind of the last 40 years. How much has changed and how much remains unchanged in terms of difference?
In Australia? Yes, well, I think a great deal has changed, but part of the message of the book is that there are some kind of fundamentals of fairly radical difference that don't change as much as you might think. So, but in many ways, when I first came to Katherine and to that part of the Central Northern Territory or mid-Central Northern Territory, there were actually Indigenous people living there who could recall their first encounters with white people in the North. These had happened either in the very last part of the 19th century or the early part of the 20th century. So we had people like that around, and they gave a certain perspective and a certain span of time to what could be found out and told about that whole historical period. But those people are all gone now. They have all died. And you have, subsequent generations. Those people, I would say one of the major things that's happened is there was a process already well in train in the 1960s by which Aboriginal people were being more or less expelled from quite a number of pastoral stations, as we call them, or ranches in the American term. And they were being expelled because there had been enacted a wage equalization statute. Previously, Aboriginal people had worked on pastoral properties for very little or no money and mostly for keep. Unions, however, found that objectionable. They said that everybody should be working for equal wage and under same conditions. And the pastoralists of the North said that if that wage equalization were to occur, they would be very inclined to get rid of most of the Aboriginal communities living on their properties because they felt that those people were not all workers. They were family groups. They were, of course, by and large, people who came from that area or from that region, and they themselves felt they had a perfect right to be there. But in the pastoral view of things, and this is a major difference and a major inequality, in the pastoral view of things, they thought these people are not contributing as workers to the enterprise. There are lots of families, there are lots of people who don't work, and so if wage equalization occurs, we will regularize by getting rid of these people. What happened then was a lot of those Aboriginal people and groups went into regional towns. So that when I first came to Katherine, there were something like 14 different Aboriginal language groups, if I can put it that way, represented and living around the town. A lot of those people had had an experience of a very sort of very minimal and poor conditions on pastoral stations, largely living in tin sheds with no running water, no electricity, very little capacity to access consumer goods. And they practically, when they lived in that way, they practically had very little money and so on. And a great deal of that has changed. In the 1970s, Many of those people moving into town were brought into the Australian welfare system. They began to receive government transfer money. The conditions of their lives changed somewhat in that town associations were formed. They started to live in more sturdily built houses, although a lot of them are not at the standard of the average European house. So in all of these ways, there has been a huge change and a very great change in, and consequently also in Indigenous people's relationship to the country from which they come. They have been distanced experientially from a lot of the country that they originated from.
Very interesting. I want to go back to Captain Cook in chapter one of your book, and you look at kind of the earliest arrival of Europeans in Botany Bay. And I think for most people would assume that kind of the story is one of conflict, but you actually say that there is a story there about a refusal to see, a refusal to see the other arriving despite their physical proximity. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what seeing means to you and what refusing to see means.
Yes, okay. Well, I was interested by these early accounts partly because there was a certain kind of stereotypy to the way that they were treated. It was often said that, you know, hostility emerged in the encounter between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. But in reading these journals, what I found that there was quite a range of reactions and quite a range of types of encounters. That doesn't do away with the fact that there were certain sort of much more stable structures in place. By that I mean that Europeans came with intent to stay, with intent to colonize. There was great difference between them and Aborigines in their sense of what they were doing. So these structures were stable and there, and they're very important. But in the different events of encounter, lots of different things happened. And so in those early chapters of the book, I tried to go into what were some of those different kinds of events? How did they play out? And I can tell you about a number of them. One of them was indeed this kind of unusual and interesting business where Aborigines are recorded from different parts of the country by these early explorers. They are recorded as having refused, basically, in some sense, to see the arriving Europeans. That is to say, the Europeans were very close to them physically, anywhere from a quarter of a mile to immediately in their presence. And sometimes we have journalists saying that they went right up to Aborigines and tried to, get them to say something or to react to their presence, and they would not. So I think from, and Captain Cook tells us an anecdote of this kind, or actually Joseph Banks, his botanist, records that their ship, which was quite large, sailed within about a quarter of a mile of some Aboriginal people on the shore. And those people refused, apparently, to look up or to acknowledge the boat's presence in any way, whereas it was perfectly within vision. They could have easily physically seen it. So the fact that these episodes of Aboriginal people absolutely not looking, not wanting to engage in any uptake, it can't be interpreted as just an inability to see physically. I think it has to be interpreted as a reaction of a much more cultural kind. And in the book, I see it as simply they're not engaging sensorially, that is, not taking up visual contact or shouting or spoken contact with the explorers in such a way that they do not admit those people into their presence. It's, you could maybe compare it to a present-day situation that we all experience. Say, if you're riding downtown in New York in a bus and you don't want to engage in any kind of banter, chit-chat with people across from you, you can avoid looking at them, can't you? Mm-hmm. You can look down, you can refuse to meet their eyes and so on. Well, on some scale, I think that's what these Indigenous people were doing. They were responding by not engaging, And we can only guess how long you can continue to do that. It's a kind of transitory reaction. If somebody is, you know, right in your face, waving at you and trying to get you to talk to them, obviously your refusal to engage with them can only last so long. But again, this was a kind of reaction that's recorded from all over the continent. It's recorded from Cape York. It's recorded from Central Australia. It was recorded by Captain Cook and Joseph Banks. It was recorded from Western Australia. So I think we have to take it as a kind of response that people were attuned to, the idea that not engaging was somehow going to make it possible to not have to deal with these people and to not place oneself within their power in some sense.
Chapter 3 is really interesting. It also sort of deals with a kind of seeing, and that is how Indigenous and non-Indigenous people see things, and I put things in quotes. It was really interesting to read that in the many Aboriginal languages, you have yet to find an Aboriginal word for thing. How did the two, kind of populations see or not see things?
Yes, it is. It is interesting. One of the, I have become acquainted with quite a number of Aboriginal languages of that area of the Northern Territory where I've been. It's an area of very high language diversity, and I've studied a number of those languages quite closely. In none of them is there a word that we could translate as thing. So people can, of course, refer to things very specifically. They can talk about this kind of tree or that kind of item or something. There is, in some languages, a word that is probably the most general thingy kind of word, which means something like swag. That's an Australianism. I should translate it. It means something like bedding or bedroll or something like that. But other than that, there really isn't a word that easily translates into thing. And so while I say that one always has to be a little cautious about moving from language to generalizations about culture and behavior, it does seem to be really important that there is no such word. What I make of it is that there is, underlying that, a very profound difference in the way that Indigenous people related to things as things of value. And so one of the principal interests that I have in a couple of these chapters is showing how people related to other people as the highest priority, if you like, as the thing of greatest value, their relationship to others. And I think that that in a way captures one of the most profound differences that on early encounter with Europeans, Aborigines were experienced foreignness in meeting them. They, of course, noticed that they were very different in some ways, but they kept also looking for sameness and commonality. They were looking for signs of shared humanity and shared characteristics and so on. And one of the big interests that they had on those encounters was figuring out whether the arriving Europeans were the same as themselves with regard to sex. So when they saw these Europeans arriving, explorers and so forth, one of the immediate reactions that they had was they wanted to get to figure out what was beneath their clothes. And this was something that the incomers found rather difficult to deal with. They were not, in general, very inclined to take off their clothes and show the Aboriginal people what they wanted to see. There was an occasional explorer, like a guy named Philip Gidley King, who actually instructed his underling, a sailor, to do just that, to satisfy this curiosity by dropping his pants so they could see what this person was like. And when the Aboriginal people saw that he was indeed shaped rather like themselves, they gave a great shout of admiration. To me, that stands for the fact that they were looking for signs of something in common. And when they recognized it, they found that to be something to celebrate.
Francesca, we're running short on time, so I want to ask you one kind of final wrap-up question, and that is, bringing the state into the story. As you were writing and as you were finishing, and now that the book has come out, Australia has been having a national debate about constitutional recognition and what the state should do to kind of recognize these issues of difference. What does kind of looking at this long history that you've researched help us kind of think about what Australia might do in the future?
Well, yes, as you're saying, Jason, recognition in some sense is a theme that opens the book and it closes the book. So in the early part of the book, we have these questions of visibility, the extent to which Indigenous and non-Indigenous people were willing to engage with each other. The last part of the book has to do with this theme of recognition on the more national level. And it's been a debate and a discussion in Australia for years in various ways. It's now come to be cast as a debate around constitutional recognition. So it's been noted and said that the Australian Constitution is a kind of dry and fairly mundane document, and it doesn't have anything of any sort of significance about Aboriginal people in it. It does have a couple of clauses, but they're held to be problematic in a couple of ways, and they're sort of procedural, if I can put it that way, to shorten that discussion. So it's been said that what we should have is some part of the Constitution that gives much clearer recognition to the fact that Aboriginal people were originary, that they have an enormous role to play in Australia and so on and so forth. But what has seemed to me to be the stumbling block is that Aboriginal people, Indigenous interests in Australia have been confronted with this issue for many decades about whether they will be recognized and how they will be recognized. And there are now important spokespeople and groups that want to be recognized in a sense that I'll call political. What they have asked for is what is called a voice to Parliament. So they want to have a kind of group or formation that is directly represented in Parliament and that will have the capacity to examine any forms of activity in Parliament or any forms of legislation that have implications for Indigenous people. Now, that is something that has been, this request to have this voice to Parliament was formulated in a meeting of several hundred Indigenous people in Central Australia at the Rock, Uluru, the big orange rock, in May of 2016. And they came up with a concerted view that this was what they wanted to go forward, a voice to Parliament. That request sort of floated around in government circles and in the media for a period of time, and then it was kind of very quickly and brusquely dismissed by the Prime Minister, who said, if we do this, it will look like a third chamber, and it will look as though we're giving special representational capacity to Indigenous people over everybody else, and so it will look unfair, unequal, and so on. And so he very radically and rapidly sort of brushed it aside. Well, I don't think, however, that the request for that has gone away. It's still being discussed and debated right now. It's come back, if you like, on the agenda since that brusque dismissal. And I do think that for the longer term future, there will have to be found a way of giving and creating for Indigenous people a much more acute and effective form of representation at the national level. There's been a long history of there not having such effective representation. So that's what I think will have to happen in the long term. But having said that, I think that recognition is clearly of this political kind. Recognition is not something that the Australian government will give easily. There's this constant return to an argument that it's somehow unfair that Indigenous people be differently represented from anybody else or be represented as a special group. And so I think recognition will not be easily given. It's not something that can be simply given in any case. It's being struggled for, however, and I think that that struggle is ongoing.
Very interesting. Francesca, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. That's Francesca Merlin. She's professor of anthropology at the ANU. Her new book is Dynamics of Difference in Australia, Indigenous Past and Present in a Settler Country. It was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2018. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.